Hi, welcome back. This is Chicken Philosophy, and today we're reading Mech and Revelations. I usually have the book in my hand and I show it to you, but it's over there. Doing it a little differently today. What can I say?
Editor Edward here. Gwydion forgot to mention this is Mech and Revelations part 72, which is the number of points there are on this star symbol thing, which happens to be, I don't know if you knew, this is my old business card. And that image, if it looks familiar, then you must have seen at least part of one episode of Buddhist Books Podcast, because this is the image basically at the beginning. And actually, it's this these days because we went vertical. But anyway, yeah, so part 72, so this is going to hang out up there for the duration.
Yeah, cool. It's Sunday. Sunday is my day off from dieting and exercise and whatnot, so got this fancy cup of coffee here. It's just such a nice cup, see? Latin quarter. Setting aside all of the buttons. Not to say there's anything wrong with having buttons about everything that is implied by this Portuguese style, like tile mosaic of the words Latin quarter printed on a one-time use plastic cup in India, of which there are quite a few for me. I don't know how many like, oh God, oh Jesus Christ, or if to you, you're like, yeah, sure, why not? Where should I throw it when I'm finished with it? You know, like, I don't know who I'm talking to. I know that I'll have some things in common with some of you and other things in common with others of you. And if there's anyone out there who's exactly like me, only one of us can, no, I'm just kidding. Like, if it was like a doppelganger situation, usually only one of us shows up on the screen at a time, unless we do some special effects or whatever. All right. But so, okay, Goa, India. This episode is brought to you by this cup. Because I told Piyu that I was going to use this cup. This was going to be my special beverage for the episode. And she said, why don't you use this cup? She likes this cup. It's like a Goan style. See, it's its own kind of style. Like when the British gave birth to America and Australia kind of became something other than just British. I mean, you know, one has one's origin somewhere. But there's sort of a Goan style, which basically means that part of India that was colonized by Portugal, and then they had an Inquisition. You've heard me go on about it. Okay, that's where I am. That's where I'm talking to you from. Isn't that a trip? I don't know. Maybe. For you, it might be if you're new. If not, you might be like, okay, this is going to be a good one. No, not too good. No, it'll be fine, I think. I don't know. Yesterday we did one. I wanted to get it out of the way because I knew that I'd be in a certain headspace today, if you know what I mean. And yesterday, and next on the schedule, because I'm sticking to my schedule, I've been doing pretty good for the past 2 or 3 months. Two Chicken Philosophies, one Buddhist Books. Because what happened was we got through two full books of the Tipitaka in like a year. And then the third and fourth book, or maybe three, two and a half, something like that. I don't remember. The point is, we were doing Buddhist books every day. But it was slowly driving us insane. And so we started Chicken Philosophy as an antidote to whatever Buddhist Books was doing to us. But then we started doing like
5, 6, 7, 8 chicken philosophies in between episodes of Buddhist books. So Buddhist books slowed down a lot. And then in the past year or so, we've been toying with the idea of like being strict about. At one point, Pymander came on and said, one per one, one Buddhist books, one chicken philosophy, but that was too much. So 2 chicken philosophies, 1 Buddhist books, then it works. But the subject matter, like the reason being, is like when the episode number ends in 1, 3, 4, 6, 7, or 9, we're reading the most boring scriptures. But the thing is, they're ancient. They're the original scriptures of Buddhism. So, and they're boring. And everybody says to skip them. You know, I mean, the rules, like all the do's and don'ts for monks and how they run their 600 BC organization of an oral tradition. You know, so it's kind of like a very specific thing. And it can be pretty dry. And so I didn't want to do that on Sunday. So I was like having this tug of war on Saturday. Should I take the day off or should I do Buddhist books so that I don't end up doing Buddhist books on Sunday? And doing Buddhist books on Saturday so that I didn't have to do it on Sunday, so that I do Meccan Revelation as Gwydion on Sunday, which is something a little more fun. You know, I'm not to say Buddhist books is never fun, and not to say Meccan Revelations was always fun. These days, it's pretty much always fun. But I think that's a me thing. That doesn't necessarily reflect on Buddhism versus Sufism, per se. There's a lot of factors. But okay, so I wanted to... Okay, so here's the beverage. It's a cup of rich, cold coffee in a nice Goa cup. And it's the best thing I've had to drink since the last time I had this specific cup of coffee a week ago. See how that works. That's why Sunday is special. One of the reasons. Oh, there you are. Hi, everybody. For the incense today, as usual, let's mix it up. And got a wood one. So we got a 1, which is the top, which is Damascus, which is where the Meccan Revelations were written by Ibn Arabi, who was from what we now call Spain. And anyway, for you, most of this is review. Some of you might be like, what is this? What have I stumbled upon? What have I gotten myself into? Well, just settle in and you'll see. All right. The incense is lovely. The beverage is lovely. But Goa is a lot smaller than United States or Australia, so it's not a one-to-one in every way. But there is a Goan culture which basically originates from a Portuguese culture. I mean, there's the original people. There's the Konkani culture, and then the Portuguese culture displaced a lot of that, and then they kicked them out. So now there's like a blending of Portuguese and Konkani culture that's leaning toward Konkani now. So, but this like style of art specifically is what I'm talking about when I make the comparison between, because another difference between Goa and United States and Australia is they didn't like completely wipe out and displace and put in camps like the people that were here. I mean, they did, but only for 100 years, and it was like 400 years ago. And now things are... Never mind, I'll just... So, but all of that being said, there was a past before the Portuguese. And so here's this book called Inside Goa, which I'll put a link in the description if you'd like. It's very nice. See, it's like a window. Oh, open up the window and you get to see what's on the other side. So I'm going to randomly select something toward the beginning. Around the year 1400, Anno Domine, or Common Era, for those of you in 2026. No, I'm just kidding. The Zuari River became too shallow for seagoing ships. By then, an alternative port had been developed on the north bank of the Mandovi River. Now, if I
had a little bit of a stronger pitching arm. And I'm not exaggerating. Like, as a human being on Earth, if I stood on top of the building I'm on right now and chucked a rock in the right direction, okay, maybe if I had slightly superhuman, but not too superhuman. Like, I think maybe like, if you took the Olympic champion thrower of objects and took, like, the ideally made paper airplane, you could get it into the Mandovi River from where I'm sitting right now. Okay, anyway, about 10 miles from its mouth, it was called Ella. But not, it would seem, by the outside world. The Portuguese never took to calling this other town by any name other than Goa. That's all they're going to say about the pre-Portuguese history of... Oh yeah, Mohammed bin Tugby. So that's what I was getting at, is this was... There's some Islam here as well as Catholicism, and then the new folks, the Hindus. There were Hindus here before, but they got rid of them. Actually, they did, and then they came back. But there was a period of time where it was illegal. But that was 400 years ago, you know, and it's sort of like, these days everybody gets along, so it's sort of like, I don't know, I feel awkward even talking about it, because nobody really talks about it. In fact, a lot of people don't know about it, but I don't know. Like, I met a guy up in Northeast India who said that he didn't think that people should learn history, and I couldn't take him seriously after that. But I don't know. I can kind of see where he's coming from, but it's a little bit of a... I think it's better to learn it and find a way to process it in the right way, but sometimes it's rough because, you know, you learn it and then you end up with these passionate feelings that you feel like that tie you to your family and your land and your ancestry and all the people that look like you, that make you resent as a collective a different group who looks different and has different names. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, yeah, I mean, it's important to know history, I think. But if there's a way to avoid, like, being... I don't know, radicalized by it. You know what I mean? Like, if we can all agree that, you know, like, ahimsa is good, getting along is good, and fairness and respect, mutual respect is good, then wouldn't that be a nice world? I don't know. All right, enough about that. Let's continue on with the show. Next comes the Persian Sufi poet from the 1400s, I think, that same time period, whose name happened to be Hafiz. So right where I'm sitting, 600 years ago, there might have been a man in Ella, as it was known before it was called Goa by the Portuguese. I mean, they called it that, but then who cares? But then once they took over and then told everybody, yes, this is what we call it, now it's its name. But back in Ella 600 years ago, someone could have been sitting on this very spot where I sit now, reading some Hafiz, back when Hafiz was first getting published. And reading a poem like The Thousand-Stringed Instrument. I know we've read it before, but it's a good one. The heart is the thousand-stringed instrument. Our sadness and fear come from being out of tune with love. All day long, God coaxes my lips to speak so that your tears will not stain his green dress. It is not that the friend is vain. It is just your life we care about. Sometimes the beloved takes my pen in hand, for Hafiz is just a simple man. The other day the old one wrote on the tavern wall, quote, "The heart is the thousand-stringed instrument that can only be tuned with love." End quote. Hey, BT... All right, I could say, hey, Editor Edward, could you play the clip from 2024 Mechan Revelations of BT talking about the color green in Islam.
Green in Islam. Green appears in the Quran 6 times. This is from Clothing and Colors in Early Islam. It's a PDF you get when you Google colors in Islam. Green appears in the Quran 6 times as an adjective and once as a participle. The Quran mentions green in 2 contexts. The first is the description of the believer's clothing and furniture in heaven. The second is descriptions of vegetation and fertile lands. Green is a recommended color for both men and women. Green and white together constitute the primary colors of heaven. Although the symbolic meanings of green are contradictory, since on the one hand it is the color of degeneration, and yet on the other it is attributed to growth, Islam has chosen to adopt its positive meanings.
Right, so, yeah, that's why God was wearing a green dress in that one. Okay, there you go. Now I shall get to the main event for today, which is to say, more Michel Chodkiewicz. We're going to be reading Michel Chodkiewicz for a few more episodes before we get back into the Ibn Arabi. But Michel Chodkiewicz is cool. Let's put up his picture. Michel, ma belle, these are words which go together well. All right, thank you, Michel. Chapter 3, quote, how God transcends what is implied by the words he uses in reference to himself in his books, in the words of the messenger's speech, end quote. I want to make my next book, I'm gonna keep his title, his chapter titles in mind when titling my chapters, because I kind of dig the run-on sentence chapter titles. Okay, continuing. Brings up the paradox of Tashbih, the, quote, similarity, end quote, between God and his creatures, as seen in Quranic verses and hadith. As seen in Quranic verses and hadith. It just sounds like a trailer for a movie or something like that. Never mind. From the director who brought you, God, quote, sits, end quote, upon the throne, quote, becomes angry, end quote, quote, smiles, end quote, and, quote, holds the hearts of his believers in his hands, end quote. Reconciling these statements with Tanzi, divine transcendence, was a major problem in Kalam from very early on. It clearly was not in theology that Ibn Arabi sought the solution. The only kind of speculative knowledge possible where God is concerned is the via negativa, randomly throwing some Latin in there, that's nice. In parentheses it says al ilim bi ul salb. Guys, you forgot to include English, or I guess French, because if it had gotten to that far. I mean, Latin is almost French, so sometimes I notice, like in English translations of like Tellier de Jardin, maybe it's a French thing. When they use Latin, they don't bother to tell you what it says because it's basically almost French anyway, you know? The powerlessness of akal, the intellect, is radical. Not in like a fun way. Is radical. The powerlessness is radical. God is only known, what? God is known only by God. A statement that in the Shaykh al-Akbar's metaphysical doctrine does not lead to the agnosticism one might logically deduct. Can you guess why? What's the missing ingredient? God, you can't know God unless you're God. Well, what if you are God? Aha! Aha! There's the spoon. Anyway, deep cut. These days. Right, anyway. In the Shaykh, right. Chapter 4, on the cause of the beginning of the world. Getting back, what started the start? What began the begin? Is the first outline that is developed to any degree. There will be others. See, this is one of those things that came out of Spain around those centuries, you know, 1280, 1180, whatever. On the role the divine names play, quote, producing their effects in this world. Weren't we just talking about this on the Nagamati, the Elohim? End quote. They constitute the, quote, primordial keys, end quote. Quote, to every reality in this world, there is a corresponding name that is specific to it, and that is its lord, end quote. Now, usually these days, I ignore bracket parentheses. Except for sometimes, when it just calls out to me to be mentioned and pointed out. There were bracket parentheses there, which means it wasn't in the original Ibn Arabi. It was added to by the translators to help clarify the meaning. I would like to read that Ibn Arabi quote again, without what's in bracket parentheses. To every reality, there is a corresponding name that is specific to it. And that is its Lord, end quote. And I'd just like to just ask into the void, why did they choose to put in this world, to every reality in this world, as opposed to what? Other ones? You mean other realities? Wouldn't that be included in what he's saying? I'm just saying. To every real reality, not some fantasy reality. Realities in the world. What world? The world in this reality? Yeah. What about realities outside of the reality that this world is in? What? What's a world? I don't know. They used to say universe. I mean, these days they used to say world, now they say universe. You know. But I don't know. Reality, multiverse, at a certain point, is it no longer the modern day equivalent of what used to be summed up by the word world? You know? Like, in the whole world. What, the sky, the earth? What about what's beyond that? What's beyond? Have you heard? You know, now it's like, yeah, we got a telescope floating out there in the sky looking out, as you wouldn't believe. Let me explain it to you. I won't explain it to you because you should at least have heard a little by now. I mean, being in this day and age, watching YouTube, you know, galaxies and stuff. I know it's all a conspiracy, NASA conspiracy, right? I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there's people out there that say that. And God bless them. Continuing. Each of them eager to manifest itself. Eager to manifest itself in accord with the pre-existing model and divine knowledge. Ooh, I can't wait to manifest myself according to the pre-existent model of divine knowledge. Come on, Michelle, you can do better than that. Haven't you read Hafiz? Throw in a little... Makes use of the intercession of the seven Ummahat al-Asma, the, quote, matriarchal names. Michelle, could you put the English in the text and the Arabic in the parentheses, not the other way around? Just saying. That in turn call upon the name Allah. Which turns toward the essence that commands that the realities these names express be brought into existence. This early sketch of a cosmogony will come up again in chapter 6, but after another intervening chapter added to chapter 2 on the science of letters lead us from the great book of the universe back to the book strictly speaking, that is, to the Quran. The proceeding had thus prepared us for this give and take between two homologous forms of divine speech. There is necessarily a correlation between the Fatiha, the surah that opens the Quran, and which Ibn Arabi will comment on here, and what opens the universal manifestation Between the book and the universe, there is man. The grain of sand between the two cones? Anybody watching the Carl Jung, who also watches Mechan Revelation, comment below. The ultimate purpose of both, the one and the other, and whose calling it is to decipher both. All right. One further analogy is added to the symmetry between the cosmogonic process and the process of revelation with a capital R, and that is the symmetry that can be seen between the forms of divine discourse and the phases of spiritual realization through which man effectively becomes the Tarjuman of the Kalimat. A long exegesis on the Basmala, the first verse of the Fatiha, and more specifically on the letter Ba at its beginning, once again transfigures the grammatical vocabulary. We have already noted how rich traditional terminology is in regard to the harakat and their roles in case endings. Here, because of their etymology, the terms used to denote the genitive, the accusative, and the nominative are related to the 3 degrees mentioned in one of the Prophet's axioms, al-Islam, outward submission to God, al-Iman, inner faith, al-Ihsan, perfection. The mim, that is the last letter of the word basmala, is elevated. That is, it carries the sign of the nominative, literally elevation, raf, literally elevation. Okay. While the name is none other than the named, than the named with a capital N. So I thought it was Named, N-A, capital N-A-M-E-D, when there's random Arabic words thrown in. I was like, the Named, no, the named. It's like my sister's old friend was like, what's a menus? And then she, well, what? It was menus. Anyway, the named and the servant is identified with his master, or Malwa, or what? Maula, if you're looking for a fun new name for whoever. This ascension of the mim from the world of ubudia, of ontological servitude or indigence, is thus the exact equivalent of the mirage. That's the going upward, the ladder, the, you know, rising up. The mirage, when he went to the 7 heavens and talked to the prophets, and like it, there's more than one, but that was Ibn Arabi's, and like it reverses the process of manifestation. This is because the Ba in the Basmala, which is the instrument of creation and revelation, has the contrary effect, from a grammatical point of view, of imposing the genitive case, and thus literally of lowering. Realizing that the Abd and the Rab are identical is thus the privilege of the man in the nominative. Michelle, you've lost us a long time ago. We're only still watching because of the music. Thank God for the music. Stop talking about grammar and let us get back to the translation. Okay. We're okay with Ibn Arabi. How much more of his blathering do we have to get through before... A lot. We're on page 30. We need to get to 43. So it'll be part 74, 75 before we actually get back to the good stuff. Michelle, I'm sorry. I'm talking smack because you're talking about nominative. I'm sure it's important. I should know this. This should all be so second nature that I'm like, nominative, genitive. Oh, yeah. God in the genitive instead of the nominative. But I just didn't pay attention that day in school. Which day? All of them.
He whom a vertical course, quote, the straight path, end quote. Okay, now you're speaking my language. It's, oh, straight and narrow, straight between the pillars, like yin and yang, and Buddhism, right? Or something? Non-dual? Sounds good to me. It all kind of right down the middle. Bullseye, right? I mean, leads back from Asphal Safilin from the extreme depths to the place where he again finds the perfect stature that was originally his. All right. I mean, you know, metaphors aside, I'm all for what I think you're talking about. As in chapter 2, I mean, I think. Ibn Arabi's hermeneutics use all the, that's like study of scripture or something, right? Isn't it? Put that, please, thank you, editor. It's not a word I use in regular speech, but hermeneutus, this guy, this was the BT talked about hermeneutus. That was the original name of the LA sanctuary that was eventually the sanctuary of Hermes Trismegistus was Hermeneutus, which sounds like it could be, is that like Hermes and Anubis? Actually, it's Horus and Anubis. Heru Empt Onpu, or Emp, M, depends on whether you pronounce the P and the T. But anyway, Hermeneutus is like the, what it became, right? Never mind. Syncretization and all that stuff, I'll say. I won't say good stuff, because somebody will at me in their heart. Ibn Arabi's hermeneutics use all the aspects. Morphological, syntactical, graphic, of the text of Revelation. Now, of course, Revelation in this context means Meccan Revelation, and well, he does use eschatology as a way of talking about his mysticism, maybe, at times, or all the time, or some of the time, or always kind of there under the surface, or never too far from what he's saying. Other than that surface resemblance between the revelations he's talking about and the name of the book about the apocalypse, which is where you part the veil of the bride at the wedding, the rending, something like that, right? Anyway, never mind. Words, right? Which is the spoken word, which is also writing, but which is also writing. The text of Revelation, which is the spoken word, but which is also writing. The two dots under the Yah in the name Al-Rahim, the All-Merciful, are related to the two feet that God, seated upon the throne, set upon the footstool, which themselves symbolize commandment and interdiction. Now, I hate to say it, but I'm going to share it because I'm wearing the hat. Yod, as some of you know, it means hand in Hebrew. And Arabic and Hebrew are closely related Semitic languages. I'm assuming that the Yah is a letter that is cognitive with Yod. Except in this specific context, it's referred to the two feet set upon the footstool. So immediately, into my mind, this comes to mind. But these two dots represent the place of the taking off of the sandals, which for Moses, and for anyone else who gets close to God, stands for going beyond duality. Is that why Tarantino... The commentary on the Fatiha, whose homologue in the cosmic order is the Insan Kamil, or Hakika Muhammadiya, is followed by verses from Surah Al-Baqarah, quote, commentary, end quote. This is Michel talking, saying about the word commentary. Commentary is actually a less than satisfactory word for what follows. Ibn Arabi authors neither a Tafir in the classical sense of the word, nor a Tawil, which would be an allegorical exegesis, but rather, to use words that come up often in his writing, Isharat, meaning allusions, with an A, to certain unnoticed, and thus occasionally quite surprising, meanings. Okay, so he's like, hey, look at this line from the Quran. I'm going to give a commentary about it. What about this? And it's like, oh, shit, I never would have seen that. Basically, to translate, I think, is what Michel was saying in a very French way. Keep reading. The Arif B. Lalah, L-L-A-H, so I assume, contemplates the divine beauty that exists in everything, and of which everything is a reflection. Maybe it's a different kind of beauty. This leads him to perceive the positive meanings in the verses, whose obvious meanings, about which there is no question, is negative. Oh, hey, okay, Michel, I see what you're saying about what he's saying. I like to, when Michel says stuff that I like, my cognitive bias is inclined to, I've reverse trained myself. So rather than, I'm always skeptical when I want to agree with somebody who, you know what I'm saying? Especially who's proven himself to be kind of on a different track as far as like, he wants you to think Ibn Arabi is like this, but there's other folk out there who wants you to think, no, he's not like this, he's like this. But I kind of like Michel's perspective, not to say I think it's always correct, but I'd like for it to be correct in this case. Continuing. Finding positive in the negative. I guess that's not like that big of a, like if a kid asks the Sunday school teacher, like, why did God drown everybody in the world? Isn't that terrible? Like they try to find some good in drowning everybody in the world to like explain to this child why, you know, God isn't a cruel, sadistic monster, you know.
Done out of love.
These allusions may be scandalous to the unknowing. Tell me more. Who do not know that each word of the Quran is simultaneously pronounced for all eternity and for each being perpetually new. Since there is an incessant renewal of creation. I mean, sure, okay, incessant can be a neutral word. It just means it doesn't cease. But incessant, it just sounds like an incessant, you know, doesn't it in English have a negative connotation? Maybe the negative connotation isn't there in French to whatever word incessant is probably originates from, you know what I mean? Anyway, it sounds like a French imported word. It's like, you know, like mowing the lawn, yeah, I'll mow it this week, next week there'll be more grass to mow, pull the weeds, yeah, next week there'll be more weeds to pull. Seems there's an incessant renewal of creation, you know. There is an incessant renewal of the divine word. In one stunning reversal, although he never deviates from the literalness of the text, upon which, moreover, all his exegesis is based. Based has a different meaning now. But in case you were like, yeah, you're not paying attention, just like, yeah, Ibn Arabi's based. No, he's saying, you know, every once in a while, the mystic who's poetry we all love comes back and says, now you all know that this shit's literally true. It's like your fucking grandma, you know, like, oh, okay, so now we're actually fundies. Now this is where I like to imagine, you know, that there's a guard nearby and he's like, well, what are you writing there? Oh, it's just writing about how everything in Islam is literally true. Bye. Okay, let's get back to the mysticism. But I don't know. Maybe not. I don't think so, actually. I used to imagine that. In fact, I used to tell people that's what it was, but I don't think so. It's okay. Not that there's anything. I mean, there's probably stuff wrong with that, but, you know, it's all right. You don't have to be 100% in agreement with someone to appreciate what they say or, you know, to, like, really appreciate half of what they say. You know what I mean? Ibn Arabi discovers that God, quote, has concealed his friends, or his saints, in the guise of his enemies, end quote. The, quote, unbelievers, end quote, in verse 6, are indeed that. But behind this meaning, there is another that reveals the etymology of the verb kafara, to hide or cover. So he's basically like a Kabbalist. He's kind of like saying, yeah, well, look at this word, though. The numerical value, you know. No, I mean, he hasn't talked about numerical value yet, but to hide or cover. From this perspective, the divine verse describes... From this perspective, the verse describes, quote, those who have hidden what secrets of union have appeared to them, end quote. Whether the prophet exhorts them or not, quote, they do not believe, end quote. But it is because they know with knowledge that, with knowledge they have received from God alone. According to verse 7, where the description of unbelievers continues, quote, he has placed a seal over their hearts, end quote, but such that there is no room in them for anyone other than him, quote, and over their ears, end quote, so that they might hear no other words in the universe than his. He places, quote, a veil over their eyes, end quote, but it is the veil of the resplendent divine glory. Is that what that is? I was wondering what material they use. The punishment with which they are threatened is being returned to the creatures that tear them away, in appearance only, from contemplation of the unparalleled one. I was just punishing them for interrupting my meditation. What? Ahimsa. It's called ahimsa, guys. No. But it is this return, sacrificial and painful, that will allow them to reach the summit of holiness by joining together the knowledge of the one in the many and the many in the one. Wholeheartedly agree with that. In a few lines, it, e pluribus unum, right? Emphasis on the pluribus. I don't know. I think a lot of people have an oversimplified view about that. Because I didn't get the impression. Like, the hive mind reminded me just as much of the familiar groupthink as it does of some hypothetical, like, socialist or communist one. Like, so the people that are like, yeah, she represents capitalism in America, right? And they're the Chinese, you know. Like, No. Get your head out of your ass and stop making YouTube videos, all right? And yeah, I know. Three fingers point back when one finger points forward, so yeah, I know. Keep making. I'm just fucking with you. Anyway, who am I talking to? whoever. No one. Really no one. Not you. Certainly not you. You're fucking cool. Some other assholes. Anyway, we'll finish this paragraph. I think my brain is finally done reading. Yes. In a few lines, it adumbrates the theme that will come back with both additional breadth and depth in chapter 45. I mean, depth is good, but breadth? Yeah, well, there it was. And, you know, we're another step of the way closer to finishing the introduction. It was fine. It wasn't, like, torturous. But I do look forward to actually getting back to Ibn Arabi. In the future, at some point, when we get a little further into Volume 2 of The Meccan Revelations on Chicken Philosophy. Next up, oh my god, I didn't even think about this until right now. This is the moment. So, where are we? Here? Right? That's where we are now. That's Gwydion and BT. By the way, I know some of you are still not clicking the corner and maximizing this on the screen. There's stuff up here, there's stuff down here. You miss it every time. You gotta click and maximize the video on the screen. If you're gonna watch 40 minutes of a video on your phone, why not watch the whole video? Why do you need to see the how many comments and likes and what, you know? That's why that's there at the beginning of every episode. Anyway, no, okay. So this is today. Next time, presumably tomorrow or the next day, because it usually takes me sometimes it takes me 3 days to make a black and yellow episode. So that's where BT puts the cards up on the screen and Editor Edward analyzes it all later. And they're usually a little long on the longer side. So if you want to prepare, if you want to be like, this is intriguing, I'm new to chicken philosophy, and this whole thing about tarot cards and Editor Edward sounds intriguing. Well, there's like 18 of them so far, 15? I don't know how many. And they come around every cycle of 15, one per cycle of 15. And there's a playlist where you can watch any and all of them. I don't know if it starts with the oldest or the newest. I don't remember. But it's called BT's Carl Jung Tarot Episodes. Go ahead and click that playlist. Check it out. And I'll see you. As Gwydion, I'll see you again, unless I decide to do something on Gwydion's Astral Coffee House, which you should check out. By the way, that's almost 20 years old. I mean, originally. It'll say it was started in 2008, but I originally started a YouTube channel called Gwydion's Astral Coffee House in 2006, then deleted it in 2008, and then reopened a new one with the same name. And a lot of the videos that were on the original one are... Anyway. So yeah, 2006? It's now 2026, and there are 206 subscribers on my first channel. Edward's first channel, Pymander's first channel, Gwydion's first channel, Gwydion's main channel, which is Gwydion's Astral Coffee House. I pointed to it before, didn't I? If I didn't, then I did. Then anyway, what was I talking about? Oh, yeah. I was going to tell you, I went through a DJ period. It was for a whole week in February of 2016, and you can read about it in the description of the playlist called Gwydion's DJ phase. Or no, it's a video. It's a video, not a playlist. It's a 2.5 hour, I think, long video. It's the whole phase. It's right here, Gwydion's DJ phase. Check that out. I'll put that on the end screen. It's good stuff. Anyway, other than that, though, I will see you when I come around to read Divine Pymander on this next cycle of 5 in the middle of the cycle of 15 that's as yet unnamed, that we're in toward the beginning of. Never mind. Till next time.
Was it just me, or did that hourglass sound a little like a T-Rex? Now, if you would all please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. What is Fliberty and Justice, anyway?